All right, we're going to be in 2 Samuel chapter 8 this morning. 2 Samuel chapter 8. It's been a while since we were in 2 Samuel, but fortunately there's kind of a break here and it shifts gears. There's not a strong connection with the previous chapter, even though chapter 8 begins with these words, "And after this it came to pass." Okay? That's really just a connector phrase. It's not necessarily sequential in time. It's not chronological. I mean, if you look at chapter 10, verse 1, "And it came to pass after this." Chapter 13, verse 1, "It came to pass after this." But if you go and follow the stories, well, I mean, some of the things we're going to look at in chapter 8 this morning are given in more detail in chapter 10. Okay? So it's not necessarily that everything that's in chapter 8 is in chronological order. But in 2 Samuel chapter 7, we saw the Davidic covenant and David's prayer in response. That is, God made a covenant with David and said, "You're not going to build me a house, but your son will, and I'm going to build you a house that is a lineage of successors, and as a part of that lineage would come the Messiah." David was the only king that, in a sense, was a messianic king. He prefigured Christ. And it was through his line the Messiah would come. And David, as he reflected on it, gave a prayer of gratitude to God. And that was when David first became king, he established a capital in Jerusalem, politically kind of pulling everybody together. Then he worked on the spiritual aspects of that, the culmination being bringing the ark in and his desire to build a temple. And God here makes a Davidic covenant with him, which had vast spiritual implications, in that the Messiah would come from David's line. So we're doing those things. And then in chapter 8, we kind of shift gears a little bit to the administration. Okay, so we got politically pulling everybody together. We got spiritual. And then we're doing some of the political and administration is going to cross paths here. But really, chapter 8, I thought long and hard about coming up with a fancy title. And here's what I came up with: The Overview of David's Wars. Okay, that's basically what you have in chapter 8, okay? It's not real complex, but it is, there are definitely some interesting and valuable things here. You got 2 Samuel chapter 8, go ahead and hold your place there and also find 1 Chronicles chapter 18. The parallel passage to this is in 1 Chronicles 18, and much is identical. There's a few details that you'll find in one place or the other. And so we'll refer back and forth to those if you want to go ahead and put a marker there in 1 Chronicles chapter 18. We'll begin reading in 2 Samuel chapter 8 and verse number 1. "Came to pass after this that David smote the Philistines and subdued them and took Metheg-Amma out of the hand of the Philistines. And he smote Moab and he measured them with a line, casting them down to the ground. Even with two lines measured he to put to death and with one full line to keep alive. And so the Moabites became David's servants and brought gifts. And David also smote Hadadezer, the son of Rehob, king of Zobah, as he went to recover his border at the river Euphrates. And David took from him 1,000 chariots and 700 horsemen and 20,000 footmen. And David hewed the horses, hewed all the chariot horses, but reserved of them for 100 chariots. And when the Syrians of Damascus came to succor Hadadezer, king of Zobah, David slew of the Syrians 22,000 men. Then David put garrisons in Syria of Damascus, and the Syrians became servants to David and brought gifts. And the Lord preserved David whithersoever he went. And David took the shields of gold that were on the servants of Hadadezer and brought them to Jerusalem. And from Beta and from Berathai, cities of Hadadezer, King David took exceeding much brass. When Toi, king of Hamath, heard that David had smitten all the hosts of Hadadezer, then Toi sent Joram his son unto King David, to salute him and to bless him because he had fought against Hadadezer and smitten him, for Hadadezer had wars with Toi. And Joram brought with him vessels of silver and vessels of gold and vessels of brass, which also King David did dedicate unto the Lord with the silver and gold that he dedicated of all the nations which he subdued, of Syria and of Moab and of the children of Ammon and of the Philistines and of Amalek and of the spoil of Hadadezer, son of Rehob, king of Zobah. And David gat him a name when he returned from smiting the Syrians in the Valley of Salt, being 18,000 men." All right, is that enough names for you? Okay, head spinning a little bit. Hopefully we'll slow it down and catch some of the details here as we go along. We're just going to look at it in chunks according to the different people groups, okay? So the first one we have here in verse number 1 is the Philistines, okay? In verse 1, it came to pass after this that David smote the Philistines and subdued them, and David took Metheg Ammah out of the hands of the Philistines. Okay, what is Metheg Ammah? Well, that's a transliteration of two Hebrew words. Metheg means bridle, and Ammah means mother. It's a feminine form of the word mother. If you look at 1 Chronicles 18 and verse 1, it tells us what this place is. 1 Chronicles 18:1. Now after this it came to pass that David smote the Philistines and subdued them and took Gath and her towns out of the hand of the Philistines. Okay? So Gath is the primary place that was taken during this battle. Now Metheg Ammah could have been a particular stronghold guarding the way into Gath, but symbolically Metheg Ammah refers to Gath. It seems like early on, you remember when the Philistines captured the ark and God began to plague them and they passed the ark around from city to city. Here, I got a present for you. I got a present for you. And there was 5 royal cities. Well, it seems like the further along in history that you go, that Gath became the dominant city in the Philistines. And the king of Gath seems to have ruled over the others. While there may have been kings in other places, the king of Gath was kind of the leader of the Philistines. Okay? So when David took Gath, in essence, then, he had taken the capital of the Philistines. He had taken the heart of their power. And he had then neutralized them in that sense. And they became servants to David. Okay, not willingly. They were under subjection. But David turned around and did to the Philistines what they had done to Israel for so many years. You remember 1 Samuel chapter 14, Jonathan and his armor bearer, you remember the two of them went up against the Philistines? What did they go up against? They went up against a garrison of the Philistines. Okay? A garrison being an outpost or a fort. Okay? It was a place where they would keep soldiers there, and the soldiers were there for the purpose of keeping the people under control. Okay? So they put Philistine soldiers here and here and here and here, and they were to keep the Israelites under control. Well, when they finally threw the yoke of the Philistines off their neck, the Philistines went back to their own land. Well, now David's going to turn around, and he's going to put garrisons in Gath and in the land of the Philistines. So now the tables are completely turned. Israel has control over the Philistines as opposed to the other way around. Okay, that would have been significant to the Israelites. You remember, way back when Moses sent in spies, okay, they complained about the cities and different things, but one of their primary complaints was what? Giants, right? And Gath was a central location for a lot of those giants. So, you know, just from a, I hate to use the term, but from a psychological standpoint, you know, now we're not only have gotten the yoke of the giants off of our neck, but in fact now God has subdued the giants before us. I mean, that was a high point in the history of Israel, that Gath is now subdued to David. Now, this is a summary, because in one verse it says, you know, the Philistines were subject to David. But this would have been extended battle, an extended period of time. It's interesting, when David ran away from Saul for a while, where did he go? Gath, right? He went to the Achish, the king of Gath. And then he said, oh, let me have another city, and he gave him, you know, another city. And but David pretty much knew Gath, didn't he? He'd spent a while there, weeks, months. He knew the layout. He knew the territory. I can't help but think that that had to be an advantage when it came time for him to lead his armies against Gath. He knew exactly where the strong spots are, where the weak spots were, and how to go about it from a strategic standpoint. Now understand, we read in verse number 6, the end of verse 6, the Lord preserved David whithersoever he went. We'll deal with that when we get there. And ultimately, God protected him. God gave him these things. But just from a human standpoint, David has been promised much in chapter 7. Now, if David had just sat there and done nothing, he would not have enjoyed the benefits of the promises God had given him. Just because, what I'm saying is, just because God had made him a promise didn't mean he should just sit there and wait in a fatalistic way for things to happen. There were responsibilities for him to fulfill. One man said it this way: the most certain of the promises of God should be embraced in full confidence. And yet the most strenuous exertion on our part to bring about their fulfillment is reasonable. David's kingdom had been assured, 2 Samuel 7:27. But nevertheless, he set garrisons in defense of his heritage and took pains to organize his administration in a judicious way. Fatalism or presumption is irreligious as truly as is unbelief. That is, it would have been unspiritual for David to just sit there and wait for things to happen rather than doing his responsibility. And so David has been promised by God a kingdom and all this. Well, now he's going out and he's beginning to establish it. Some of this may have happened before the covenant, some of it after. But you've got a summary here, and that is Gath, the capital of Philistia, of the Philistines, the home of Goliath and his brothers. And so when that falls and it comes under David's control, that, for people who had any sense of history, should have been a high mark. I mean, we can think of significant points and significant turns in our own American history. We just had this week, we just had the anniversary of D-Day. That was a turning point in World War II. And we still look back at it, you know, with an appreciation for what happened there. This would have been one of those high water marks for the time when Gath came under control of the Philistines came under control of Israel. So we got Gath. Verse number 2, we have Moab. And he, David, smote Moab and measured them with a line, casting them down to the ground, even with two lines measured he to put to death and one full line to keep alive. And so the Moabites became David's servants and brought gifts. The casting them down to the ground literally means to cause to lay down. These are the prisoners of war. Okay, so he conquered Moab. Now, why? What's changed with Moab? Okay, wasn't it Moab where David took his parents when he was running from Saul? I believe so. I believe in 1 Samuel chapter 22, it was Moab where David took his parents down to the king of Moab and said, "Can they stay with you while Saul's chasing me?" And so, but in between that time, something's changed. Now, you remember, what's the relationship between Israel and Moab? They're distant cousins, right? Moab was descendant from Lot, from his illegitimate relationship with his daughter. Okay? But nonetheless, that would have been, you know, family, been kin to Abraham. And so Israel and Moab were kin, and for the most part, they tried to just, you know, leave each other alone. In fact, when they were going through, God told them, "I'm not going to give you Moab's land, and I'm not going to give you Ammon's land." Okay? Leave that alone. But something has changed here. Because now all of a sudden, He not only went to war against Moab, but he was very vicious with them. He says in verse number 2, he measured them with a line, casting them down to the ground. Literally means the prisoners of war, he made them lay face down on the ground. And he measured them with a line, with two lines measured he to put to death and one full line to keep alive. So the best I can understand this, he had a measuring rope or cord of some length. I don't know how long it was. We're not told. But basically, he would measure out, all right, 1, 2, 3. 1 and 2, cut their heads off. 3, they get to live. And then they would measure the next row. Okay? He's numbering them off. 1, 2, 3. 1, 2, 3. 1, 2, 3. All the ones over here, all the twos over here, all the threes over here. Kill all of them, they get to live. I mean, that's how we would do it. But that's what he was doing. He's measuring with a line. And some commentators want to say that there were only two lines. There was a kill and a live. But the most plain understanding of this is three. Two-thirds of them he killed, one-third of them he let live. This was out of character for what David would typically do with prisoners of war. This was very, very cruel, but something had happened. It could be that let me see here, it's in 1 Chronicles 18, I can find it real quick. It's not that. So, all right. But something, it's not, it was Edom that helped with it, came against him in the other war. But something has changed between David and the king of Moab. Some have speculated that maybe it was that he didn't take care of David's parents. Maybe put David's parents to death. We don't really hear much about them after David became king. But something's changed in his relationship to Moab, and he was very vicious with them. I think it's kind of funny, the end of verse 2. And so the Moabites became David's servants, notice the last phrase, and brought gifts. You think? I mean, if you're one of the lucky ones that was allowed to live, do you think you'd bring presents and try to keep David happy? I would. It just makes sense, right? But the ones that were still allowed to live, they became David's servants. They brought presents. Now, this wasn't necessarily birthday presents. These were mandated presents, okay? This was what we would call tribute, being under tribute. That is, you're going to pay taxes, you're going to bring gifts to us every year, and you're going to do what we say. So, and generally speaking, the ones that were under tribute, depending on who was in charge, they would have more or less freedom, okay? The Romans were very vicious, but certain states that submitted to Rome were given more liberties than others that really rebelled against Rome. But nonetheless, Moab became tributary. So we got the Philistines, we got Moab, then in verses 3 through 6, we have the Syrians. Okay? Where do you see that? Well, we'll get to it in a second. David smote also Hadadezer, the son of Rehob, king of Zobah, as he went to recover his border at the river Euphrates. Okay? Verse 5, when the Syrians of Damascus came to succor Hadadezer, king of Zobah, David slew of the Syrians 22,000 men. David put garrisons in Syria of Damascus, and the Syrians became servants of David. 1 Chronicles chapter 18. And David smote Hadarezer, king of Zobah, I'm in verse 3, unto Hamath, as he went to establish his dominion by the river Euphrates. And David took from him 7,000 chariots, 1,000 chariots and 7,000 horsemen and 20,000 footmen. When the Syrians of Damascus came to help Hadarezer, king of Zobah, David slew of the Syrians 22,000 men. All right, now, you hold these two spots, and I want you to find Psalm 60 with me. We're going somewhere, I promise. Psalm number 60. All right. Look at the inscription there at the above verse 1. Okay, some people want to. You'll get two different opinions on whether or not these were inspired verses of Scripture or whether they're just explanatory. I believe they're accurate and in authoritative, however you want to do it. It's interesting in the Hebrew text, to the chief musician upon Shushan Edeth Miktam of David, that's the introductory inscription. Then verse 1 starts when he strove with Aram Naharim and with Aram Zobah, whatever that's worth. But look at the inscription with me, Psalm 60, and the inscription there above verse 1. To the chief musician upon Shushan Edeth Miktam of David to teach. And when he strove with Aram Naharim and with Aram Zobah, when Joab returned and smote of Edom in the Valley of Salt, 12,000. Okay? Now, why is that significant? Okay? Well, this kind of ties everything together for us. Okay? Aram Naharim. Aram, A-R-A-M, Aram, that's the Hebrew word for Syria or Syrian. Okay? That's that word, the name Aram is also. It's also used of one of the sons of Shem, one of the grandsons of Nahor, had that same name. But this was the name given to the inhabitants of Syria. Now, this name, the title here in Psalm 60 is interesting. Aram Naharaim. Okay? Aram is Syria. Nahar, N-A-H-A-R, that's the word for river. And then that I-M on the end of it is a plural ending. Okay? So it's the Syrians, the ones of the river, or the rivers. Okay, so in that part of the world, what are the rivers? If it's the river, it's the Euphrates. The rivers would be the Tigris and the Euphrates. So in other words, these were the Syrians from the region of Mesopotamia. Okay, the region near the rivers, the two rivers. So if you've got your map of Israel in your mind, Syria and Damascus, that's north of Jerusalem. And then the other Syrians would have been to the east, over towards the Euphrates. So basically we're talking about a region north of Jerusalem and north of the 12 tribes. Okay? That's the people against whom David fought. Okay? So you have Aram, the Syrians of the rivers, and with Aram Zobah, the Syrians of Zobah. Okay? And so you got that matches perfectly with the names that we read over in Samuel and Chronicles. David smote Hadadezer, son of Rehob, king of Zobah, and then the Syrians of Damascus came to succor or to help Hadadezer, king of Zobah. Okay? So all of this matches perfectly with what we're talking about. Aram Zobah, the king of Zobah, and Aram Naharaim would have been the other Syrians there, okay? So then let's read through the text of Psalm 60 and see David went against them. O God, thou hast cast us off. Thou hast scattered us. Thou hast been displeased. O turn thyself to us again. Thou hast made the earth to tremble. Thou hast broken it. Heal the breaches thereof, for it shaketh. Thou hast showed thy people hard things. Thou hast made us to drink the wine of astonishment. Thou hast given a banner to them that fear thee, that it may be displayed because of the truth. Selah. That thy beloved may be delivered, save with thy right hand. And hear me. God hath spoken in his holiness. I will rejoice. I will divide Shechem and mete out the valley of Succoth. Gilead is mine and Manasseh is mine. Ephraim also is the strength of mine head. Judah is my lawgiver. Now notice here his description of his cousins. Moab is my washpot. Okay, I didn't grow up in Hebrew culture, but it's pretty plain to me that that's not a compliment. Okay, the washpot. That's where you put all the stuff with scum and filth on it that needs to be washed, okay? Moab is my washpot. Over Edom will I cast out my shoe. Okay, again, Edom, the descendants of Esau. So he said, when I get rocks and dirt in my shoe, I'm going to empty it out on their head. That's what I think of them. Okay, again, not highly complimentary. Over Edom will I cast out my shoe. Philistia, triumph thou because of me. Who will bring me into the strong city? Who will lead me into Edom? Wilt not thou, O God, which hadst cast us off, past tense, and thou, O God, which didst not go out with our armies, give us help from trouble, for vain is the help of man. Through God we shall do valiantly, for he it is that shall tread down our enemies. Now, we've heard that verse, haven't we? Verse 12. That's one of those promises of God that's comforting in a time when it looks like things are going to blow up in our face, right? Through God we shall do valiantly, for he it is that shall tread down our enemies. Well, David right here felt like he was in a real bind. Now, based on the inscription here at Psalm 60, this is what it looks like had happened. David and the armies went out to fight against the Syrians. And while he was out to the north fighting against the Syrians, Edom down here to their south and east came against part of Israel. Now, God allowed this battle up here to be over quickly. So then David comes back to defend his territory. And David meets the Edomites in the Valley of Salt. Most likely somewhere in the region of the Dead Sea. Okay? The Valley of Salt. But what's going on? This is an overview. Okay? The things that we're reading in a few verses happen over the course of months. Maybe years. Where you got the battle against the Philistines. That was a campaign. It was a war. It wasn't just one battle. And then you have these wars against the Syrians. And based on what we read in 2 Samuel chapter 8, David smote Hadadezer, son of Rehob, king of Zobah, as he went to recover his border at the river Euphrates. Now, verse 3 of 2 Samuel 8 says, recover his border. In 1 Chronicles 18... Verse 3 says, David smote Hadarezer, king of Zobah, as he went to establish his dominion by the river Euphrates. Alright? You with me? Now, the phrase to recover his border and the phrase to establish his dominion. Border and dominion are the same word. Okay? Rendered two different ways. Okay? To recover. It's the word that means to return or to cause to return. So it looks like David went against the Syrians, and possibly in two parts. He went against them, and then that battle was over. And then as the king of Syria came down towards the river Euphrates to recover his border, that is to cause it to return, the word border and the word dominion, what was the word in Chronicles here? Let me get the right word. Yeah, it establishes dominion. The word border and dominion, both of those are the word hand. Okay? And, well, how do you get that? Well, it's pretty easy. Okay? Your dominion, that which is under your dominion, another way to say it is it's under your hand. It's under your control. Right? Your border, that which is under your hand or under your control. So he lost some of that was under his hand. The king of Syria did. Now he's going back to try to get it back, to cause it to return. And then David goes against him again. And in that same time, when the king of Zobah figured out that he couldn't fight against David by himself, he hired some more. Verse 5, the Syrians of Damascus came to succor Hadadezer, king of Zobah. So either they were his friends that just came to help him, or possibly they were mercenaries. That is, he hired more soldiers. He said, I need some help. And we find that frequently in Old Testament accounts of wars and battles. They would hire 10,000 soldiers or hire 20,000 soldiers from over here or over there to come fight. Right? So you've got David fighting against the king of Syria, and then the Syrians from Damascus come over to help. And so David takes them all out. He takes out Zobah over here near the Euphrates. Then he goes back over here to Damascus. He takes them out. He puts a garrison there. Okay, but in the meantime, we got Edom going on down here in the south. Okay, so it could well have happened that the battle with the Edomites happened in between the two, or it could have been, you know, everything happened up in the north and then they came down and dealt with Edom. But if you'll notice in the inscription in Psalm 60, it says there that Joab returned and smote of Edom in the Valley of Salt 12,000. Then in 2 Samuel chapter 8, said David got him a name, verse 13, when he returned from smiting of the Syrians in the Valley of Salt, 18,000 men. Okay? So again, this could be where he sent Joab and a part of the army to go down and fight, and David's bringing the rest of the army behind. Joab takes a group and they fight, they kill 12,000. David shows up with the rest of the army and the total deaths are 18,000. Okay. Now, 2 Samuel chapter 8 says that they killed of the Syrians in the Valley of Salt. Returned from smiting of the Syrians in the Valley of Salt. Now, it's very clear from 1 Chronicles 18 and from Psalm 60 that in the Valley of Salt, they did not kill Syrians, they killed Edomites. Okay. What happened was, he was returning from the slaughter of the Syrians, and he came to the battle in the Valley of Salt. Okay. But down here, he wasn't fighting Syrians, he was fighting Edom. So you get there in Psalm 60, Joab returned and smote of Edom in the Valley of Salt, 12,000. And you get in 1 Chronicles 18 and verse 13, he put garrisons in Edom. Here we go, verse 12. Moreover, Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, slew of the Edomites in the Valley of Salt, 18,000. Okay? So we get part of it with Joab, we get the rest of it with Abishai and David. But what's going on here, again, this is a summary. We get more details in chapter 10 of 2 Samuel on, you know, this battle with the king of Zobah. And we'll look at it in more detail then. But this is in chapter 8 of 2 Samuel, we have an overview of what's going on. So you got the picture. You got the wars with the Syrians. And then the Syrians from Damascus came over to help. And David wiped them all out. Then he comes back down. He has to fight the Edomites in the Valley of Salt. And that period, you know, those three or four verses cover months. Months of time. And possibly even a year or two. Okay? Back in 2 Samuel chapter 8, David smote Hadadezer, son of Rehob, king of Zobah, as he went to recover his border at the river Euphrates. David took from him 1,000 chariots, 700 horsemen, and 20,000 footmen. Now, I think here, again, we get little differences in between the Samuel and Chronicles account. They're not contradictory. Okay, here, the writer of 2 Samuel had a number. Okay, In Chronicles, 1 Chronicles 18, it wasn't 700 horsemen, it was 7,000. So he got the full number. Okay? Which, it, based on the size of the army and all that, 7,000 is definitely a reasonable number for all that. So you got, what's the difference between chariots and 7,000 horsemen? Okay? You know, the chariots, obviously, you're going to be pulling somebody in a chariot and they would fight from the chariot. Chariots would have been the kings and the officers and that kind of thing. The horsemen would have been a single soldier mounted on a single horse. Okay? And then you get the foot soldiers. Now, the horseman was not a luxury that David and his men had. Okay? They did a lot of their fighting on foot, you know, and hand to hand, that kind of thing. But think about that. You got the an army mostly on foot taking down 1,000 chariots, 7,000 horsemen, and 20,000 footmen. From a military standpoint, that is very impressive. Okay? But see, God constantly wanted Israel to look at it and say, the only way this happened was if our God helped us. Right? And so God told them, you're not to multiply horses. You're not to multiply chariots. The kings are not to get horses out of Egypt and that kind of thing. Solomon violated that. But God constantly put them in a position where they had to recognize, all right, if God doesn't help me, I'm toast here. Right? That's uncomfortable. I mean, our church lives there a lot of the time, right? We think, man, if we just had, you know, a little bit more resources, we could do this. We had a little bit more property, land, we could do this, you know. And oh, you know, and it seems like we're constantly right there. But that's where the Lord wants us. He wants us right there where He's taking care of us, but we recognize if significant things happen, it's because God did it. Not because we could just write the check ourselves. And as individuals and as families, God will frequently keep us there when we don't want to be there. Okay? None of us likes the squeeze. We don't like that pressure. We would rather be able to relax. But God keeps us there where we have to depend on His help and recognize if anything happens, the Lord did it. So you got David and his army mostly on foot, taking out 1,000 chariots. Some of them would have been single horse, maybe some of them two horses pulling the chariot. 7,000 horsemen, 20,000 footmen. I mean, this was a massive army, and David slew them in that battle. When the Syrians, that was just against King of Zobah. Verse 5, the Syrians of Damascus came to succor Hadadezer, king of Zobah. David slew the Syrians 2 and 20,000. Okay? Add that together, we were 42,000 footmen. Then David put garrisons in Syria of Damascus, and the Syrians became servants to David and brought gifts. Now catch the end of verse 6. The Lord preserved David whithersoever he went. That word preserved is the word Yashah. Okay? From which we get the name Joshua, which means Jehovah saves. Right? It's the word save or saved. Okay? Here, where it says the Lord preserved David, you get the exact same phrase over in 1 Chronicles 18 in verse 6. Thus the Lord preserved David whithersoever he went. We would do no damage to the text if we said the Lord saved David or the Lord delivered David. Identical in meaning. The Lord saved David. The Lord delivered David whithersoever he went. The Lord preserved David whithersoever he went. When David would look back at this battle, if he were foolish, he could gloat. He'd be like Nebuchadnezzar and say, look what I've done, and look what I've built, and look how great I am, and all that kind of stuff. But David had to look at this and say, the only way this happened was that God did it. God preserved me. And some of you may remember, this, I think it's 2 Samuel chapter 21. It's in the story of the giants. It says one of the giants was ready to kill David, and then Abishai succored David and killed the giant. And they said, look, David, you're not going out with us anymore. Well, that's one story where we get a glimpse of David almost died in battle and God spared his life. But how many times did that happen? I mean, let's rewind the tape. Go back to David runs away, goes to Gath. And they said, wait a minute, isn't this David that they sang about and said he's killed his 10,000s? So he has to feign himself to be insane to get out of there. Okay? Saul's chasing him. And then he goes in these battles. And David was not the kind of man who would sit in the air-conditioned control tower, you know, and just and give the orders. I mean, David was there with the men leading the charge. How many times did God spare David's life? We don't know. How many times did God spare our lives? Oh, well, I'm not in the military. Yesterday we were driving back this way from our vacation. We've been the north side of Atlanta. And, you know, traffic is a miracle, but traffic moving through downtown Atlanta was speed limit plus. Okay? All the way through. It's a Saturday, okay? But, you know, speed limit plus all the way through downtown Atlanta. We get up to where 85-75 split, follow 85 this way. And then I look up ahead, and there's lots of brake lights. I'm like, oh, great, we made it this far, and now we got traffic. And get on the brakes, slow down, get stopped. And about the time we get stopped, there's police officers coming down the other side, find a break in the median, and flip back, come flying back past us. And then, you know, another officer comes down the HOV lane this way. And the stopped section of cars was no more than a quarter of a mile, probably less than that. So we get up there, and the police were just getting in place and starting to direct traffic and move people around. And what's happened, there are two cars that are spun around over against the guardrail this way facing oncoming traffic. Well, a van and a car. And there's two cars over here against the concrete barrier on this side. And that happened no more than 2 minutes in front of us. Did the Lord protect us? Absolutely. And, you know, the kids are looking at that, you know, and I mean, airbags are deployed, cars are smashed. I mean, it looked like people were, for the most part, out of their vehicles. But the ambulance wasn't even there yet. I mean, how many times has that happened where the Lord preserved us? The Lord delivered us. Oh, wow, that's awesome. He did it for David. The Lord does it for us, too. I mean, and sometimes it's things that you never see. I mean, one of the interesting things on our vacation was keeping up with Seth. Okay? The boy can run. I mean, if he runs, I walk absolutely as fast as I can where I'm to the point where it'd be more comfortable to jog. I have to go that fast to keep up with him. Okay? He spent a lot of time in the strollers. We're walking around, but when we would turn him loose, you know, he walk, put him down. Run. You know, he takes off. So I let him go. I chase him. Trisha bring the stroller and I'm chasing him. But, you know, while he's just going, you know, I'm free, I'm running. You know what I'm doing? I'm watching. Okay? I'm watching for people coming. You know, and if we're in a park, you know, and one time I let him go on the sidewalk, I'm on this side of him between him and the cars. And he starts to veer this way. I'm pushing him back this way. Sometimes I grab his hand and stop him because there's somebody coming out of a store. And if he would have kept going, he runs smack into him and gets run over. Does he have any idea that I'm protecting him? No. All he knows is, I want to run and Daddy grab my hand. Walk, walk, right? That's what the Lord does for us. Protects us from things that we never see. I mean, He's got the big picture view, we've got the tunnel vision view, and we don't necessarily even see how He protects and guides. But the Lord preserves us as well, just as the Lord preserved David. So we can say with David, the Lord is my light and my salvation, in a spiritual sense, but also in the sense of our day-to-day preservation. The Lord is my salvation. The wars of David, an overview here in chapter 8, more detail in subsequent chapters, but in everything here we see the hand of God, and we need to learn to look for the hand of God in our day-to-day and week-to-week living. Serve God just as David did.